I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film. Welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. Today, I'm joined by our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello!
And his magnificent beard.
It's getting bigger by the week, Jane.
Lovely. And our online editor, Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
Who has just a lovely head of hair, no beard.
No, my head of hair is also getting longer by the day.
This is the first time I've been on the pod with Jack. And what a gorgeous voice you've got, Jack. In the office, it's normally a bit more sort of tinny and reedy. But something, I don't know what it is, but with a microphone, it's a thing of beauty. I'm enjoying it.
Right. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Jamie. Right, that's not at all creepy. Shall we talk about what we're talking about this week? We're talking to Taha Rahim about The Mauritanian, and we're reviewing that, plus Godzilla vs. Kong, Chaos Walking, Minari, and The Dissident. So shall we start off with this?
If you stray outside the designated areas, you will be removed from the island.
It's recommended you wear a hijab when visiting your client. We've had incidents of inmates spitting at female lawyers.
You want to represent the head recruiter for 9/11?
Mohamedou Oldslahi, the Mauritanian held in Guantanamo. He recruited the guys who flew your friend's plane into the South Tower.
He put those men on my husband's plane?
I'm going to make him pay.
So that's The Mauritanian, the real-life story of Mohamedou Oldslahi, a man held in Guantanamo Bay without charge and represented by US lawyer Nancy Hollander. Before we get to this, shall we hear what Taha Rahim, who plays Oldslahi, had to say when our Hollywood correspondent Adam Tanswell caught up with him?
I read that you had a little initial reservations about the role in this. What held you back and what changed your mind?
It was my mistake, because I judged the movie by his title. At the time, it was Guantanamo Diary. And as I had to turn down some offers from Hollywood, not just Hollywood, from France and sometimes Germany as well, I was like, oh, man, it's going to be the same endless story. And I always said no, and I want to do it. And I thought about Kevin, and I met Kevin many times. I worked with him. And I'm like, no, Kevin is too clever, too sensitive to tell the story this way. But instantly, when I read it, I called him and I said, look, sign me in. I'm signing, straightforward.
What research went into the role? I was going to say character, but it's a man. It's a living person, yeah.
I mean, there's the book that he wrote that gave us a lot of answers. Kevin did a very good job with Mohamedou because they've been talking on and off for years. And he recorded some moments with him. So that helped me a lot to create my character. And I watched some documentaries about Guantanamo just to feed my my character, but also my person, just so I know more about it. And when I talked to Mohamedou, it was a turning point because it's changed. I was like, okay, now that I know I have the answers of what I needed to know, it's in the back of my head. So live it there and now just connect with someone who is exceptional and try to get what you can out of him. I mean, his spirit. It's very hard to explain, but you don't know exactly how, from where you have to start. And I started to ask him some questions. And when it came to the bad memories, I felt ridiculous because I could see his face change. He was traumatized. And I was like, who am I to bring him back there? I mean, he's been through hell already. Why would I bring back those memories? And I knew that I would find my way to portray him in listening to him, see his eyes, observing. And that's what I did for, a couple of times. And it helped me a lot because I think I needed to catch his spirit to understand how he turned anger into forgiveness. It's amazing.
It's a harrowing role as well. It must take a toll on your body and your emotional state. How much of a challenge was it to switch off? And how do you switch off at the end of the day or at the end of the shoot?
At the end of the day, I wouldn't. I was too scared to lose my character. So I grabbed him and he stayed with me the whole trip, if I can say. I was afraid to lose him. You know, sometimes when you relax a bit too much as an actor, you can lose it. And to get into it, it's very hard. So I was like, no, just keep him with you. And as the shooting was like very tense, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, I didn't have a lot of time off, and I was so tired by what we were doing and the diet. So each time I would go back to my hotel room, I would sleep and, rest for the next day. It was like a boxing match. Each day was a round, but at the end of the shooting, something very special happened, and it never happened to me before. It took me 3 weeks to get out of the part, out of the character. Can't explain why, but I couldn't think otherwise. I couldn't move otherwise. It was there. And after 3 weeks, spending time with my family, I came back to my myself.
So that's Tahar Rahim talking about the Mauritanian. We know that this is about a man trapped in Guantanamo Bay without any recourse for legal action because he hasn't been actually accused of anything. He's just there as a suspect in 9/11. But it's not just about that, is it? It's about the idea of being unjustly locked up, being snatched from your family during a family wedding and never having any ability to contact them. It's also about this sort of warring legal system with Benedict Cumberbatch's lawyer, who works for the US Navy and is determined to prosecute, and Jodie Foster, a civil rights sort of lawyer and who wants to ensure that people get a fair trial, and the sort of conflict of conscience that goes into that. Did you enjoy it, Jamie?
I thought overall it was okay. I wouldn't really recommend it. I didn't love it. But what I did, just to focus on the good and why people should see it, are the performances. I mean, Jodie Foster playing Nancy Hollander, the defence lawyer. She, I think it's her first performance for 10 years, and it's so good to have her back on the screen. I was quite surprised she didn't get a nomination, Best Supporting Actress at the Oscars, because she actually won the Golden Globe for Best Supporting Actress. She's just really good, and, you know, she always brings that touch of class and that kind of drive and that, you know, she's just flinty and determined, and she's exactly what you want on your side if you're stuck in Guantanamo Bay. But even better than Foster is a central performance by Tahar Rahim, who's having a hell of a year. I mean, probably a lot of our listeners saw him in The Serpent this year. He was just mesmerizing and just terrifying, absolutely stunning performance. And he, again, is great in this. And again, he hasn't been Oscar nominated, which is really weird because he's had loads of nominations in the awards season. He's sort of been part of a chatter and part of the shortlist for the whole thing. And then he's kind of been overlooked by the Oscars, which I feel is a little bit unfair. But those two performances are great, absolutely great. So it's worth seeing for them. And it's worth seeing because it's, you know, a really well-meaning film that's still very important because Guantanamo Bay is still open. There's 40 inmates there, you know, as we speak. I think back in the day at its height, there was something like 780. So obviously not as bad as it was, but it should not be open at all. It still exists. That's something this film calls into, you know, it says that it's not just Bush, you know, his administration who were obviously behind it, but it wasn't shut down during Obama's regime, you know, and it should be shut down. So that's a disgrace and it's an important film. But apart from that, I do feel it's kind of a bit plodding. It's a lot of, you know, opening boxes of evidence and weighing through them and sifting through them. And then almost to overcome that kind of plodding nature of it, there's other scenes in it which are just far too overwrought for my liking. Like, you know, the score is really stirring. And when Tahar Rahim, you know, there's one point he's doing a speech and the light behind him is fizzing and blinking. And it's just also like underlined, and I just found it, you know, a bit too heavy-handed for my liking.
How about you, Jack?
I feel similar. I found the first two-thirds or so quite underwhelming. You know, it was a lot of, as Jamie said, evidence boxes being opened and lots of bureaucracy, which isn't really too fun to watch. But I thought the last third really hammered home how awful it was there, but was done in a way that was really engaging as well and felt really well filmed and made and tied everything together really, really nicely. But I think the journey there was so long. I liked most of the performances in it, apart from Benedict Cumberbatch. I find it so hard to take him seriously with any accent. I found it with, you know, Doctor Strange as well and all these films because he's so
doing Southern here, isn't he? Southern American accent.
Yeah, it doesn't work for me. Attempting. I think if they had cut all his bits from it, it probably would have helped the pacing of the movie. And that's, it's not, I think it's also the fact that, like, he was also supposed to be, like, the good side of America, like, the good consciousness of the American government. I think that let them off a bit.
Yeah, it does.
I don't think you need that. I think all you need to do is, this is horrible, this is just abhorrent, it shouldn't have happened. You don't need that side of it. You didn't need his character in this, I don't think. You could have had, you know, more of Tahar in it, perhaps, you know, and maybe just cut down the runtime and just not had Benedict in it.
I see what you're saying. But it is a little bit sort of like, for people who may not have been exposed to the Guantanamo diaries and not been aware of the news reports of what happened in Guantanamo and the way prisoners were treated and this basic human right that you have generally in democratic places, that you have a right to a trial, you have a right to, you know, visitation, you have the right to be treated well. And none of this is happening in Guantanamo. So I suppose from that point of view, if you've never, ever sort of really seen that or appreciated it, it's quite an eye-opener, isn't it? Your level of enjoyment depends on how much you already know about this situation. And if you've read the Guantanamo diaries, this isn't going to enlighten you at all. But the thing that I sort of took from it that I liked was the spirit of old Slahi himself. And they really, like you said, Jack, this sort of end part of the film, really sort of talk about his great sort of kindness and love for man and just forgiveness of everything he's been through, the fact that he still remains an upbeat person who tries to see the best in people and is trying to have this new life after the events that happen in the film. I found that quite inspiring. So it's weirdly the thing that they weren't trying to inspire me with. It was the secondary thing that actually inspired me.
Those elements made me just want to watch a documentary about him instead.
Yeah,
maybe a couple of interviews with him, because even, you know, over the credits, you get to see him in, you know, in real life. And it is quite moving to think the ordeal he's gone through. It made me want more of that. And I think that's why the kind of final third worked for me. I wanted more of that. And I almost wanted more of the journey after to see how he dealt with it, because he did seem like such an interesting and inspiring figure.
And the thing is as well, Kevin MacDonald, who directed it, he is a great documentary filmmaker. You know, he made Touching the Void and One Day in September and Marley. And I think he's a much better documentary filmmaker than he is, you know, narrative fiction. I mean, he started well with Last King of Scotland, but since then, I don't think he's really hit anything out the park. So what Jack's saying there, or there is something to that, that maybe he should have just gone away and, you know, sifted through everything, dug it all up and done a great documentary on it. Maybe that would have been more interesting. Maybe the one other thing we should say, just for anyone who doesn't really know the inside story of Guantanamo Bay, I can't imagine as many, but if you don't, you know, this film, it does show the torture scenes, you know, that Slahi was subjected to. So there's psychological torture, physical torture, sexual torture. It's really grim stuff. So some viewers may find that a bit much.
It could be a trigger. Yes, well said, Jamie, that isn't pleasant watching. The film that I kept thinking about when I was watching it was Zero Dark Thirty, and how it's a sort of similar thing. The dogmatic pursuit of evidence and people opening boxes, as you say, and sifting through papers, and that sort of pursuit of a criminal from 9/11. Yeah. And I just felt like that was so much more alive and electric than this.
It's so much more propulsive and it's got so much more clarity. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty is a great film.
And really does delve into that as well, that sort of crisis of conscience that people go through as well in the pursuit of justice and the people that get in the way of that and what can happen. So I think probably I would say if you're going to watch a film like that, just revisit Zero Dark Thirty. What about you guys?
I think I agree with you, Jane. I think go back and watch Zero Dark Thirty instead, which I know Jamie was talking about this movie not being in Oscars chats so much, but I found it slightly underwhelming. So I can kind of see why it fell by the wayside a bit.
For me, like I said earlier, I think the two performances, especially Tahar Rahim, are very good, but everything else around it isn't so good. So I'm not sure I could recommend it.
Okay, so that is The Mauritanian, which is available on Amazon Prime now. Okay, so shall we move from real life horrors to very much not real life with this.
These are dangerous times. Godzilla's out there and he's hurting people and we don't know why.
There's something provoking him that we're not seeing here.
I'm of the same opinion.
The myths are real.
Yeah.
There was a war. And they're the last ones standing.
I keep reaching for greatness because I'm built from it.
It's Godzilla versus Kong. It hardly needs a setup, does it, Jack? What's it about?
It's about this giant lizard and this oversized ape. They're going at it. Not in the way Jamie's thinking right now.
I'm not thinking that. Outrageous.
Please don't bring it down to Jamie's level.
That's just outrageous.
There is slightly more to it. There's a lot of human characters here. There's Alexander Skarsgård and Rebecca Hall, who are working together to get Kong to the hollow earth for a reason. And then there's and then the
did
mean,
you miss the reason?
No, I kind of get it. I mean, it's there's
there
a company...
really need to be one though, does there, frankly, with this film?
I mean, this is my issue for a lot of it. I mean, the reasoning's a bit wild, isn't it? I mean, it's this company Apex who want to get Kong to lead them to the Hollow Earth because they can't make it themselves, and there's this thing that he needs to unlock down there, and there's all sorts of shenanigans. And then also on Earth, because obviously, you know, Kong's only one part of this duo, there's Godzilla, and he's destroying all these Apex facilities, and Millie Bobby Brown's there with Brian Tyree Henry and Julian Dennison, and they're trying to work out why Godzilla would be targeting these places.
Yeah, because the last time we saw Godzilla, he was sort of the de facto defender of the Earth, wasn't he? But now he's turned. And actually, do we care why? Because don't you just pay your ticket to see those two bash each other in various areas of the world, like in the sea, on land, in cities? Does that satisfy?
I found all of the human stuff a bit underwhelming, to say the least. I wasn't really engaged in any of it. And like Jack said, there's quite a few humans scurrying around. But for me, this movie is saved by the fact that when Kong and Godzilla do go at it, they really go at it. The fight sequences are pretty grandiose and they're very well choreographed and they're quite inventive. Like you just said, Jane, they move around different places. Like there's a fantastic, massive jewel in Hong Kong, so you've got all the sort of neon skyscrapers, and it's great to look at. And just personally, having not seen many blockbusters for the last year because everything's been on hold with the pandemic, I just really enjoyed that aspect of it. I mean, I had to watch it on my TV, but it was still just lovely to watch two giant beasts smack the hell out of each other. I just found that really
turn the sound right up. Watch them go to town.
So I probably liked it more than I would have done if we'd been having our usual sort of two or three blockbusters a month. But having said that, overall, you know, it's a fourth film in the MonsterVerse and there's still problems with it, like there are with all of them. And for me, Godzilla, the original Gareth Edwards Godzilla, and I think it was 2014, is still the best one because it just gets Godzilla so right. You know, that film has its problems, but Godzilla, the beast, is wonderful and has so much personality. And in this film, he's kind of, because he's a bad guy, you don't really get that. It focuses more on Kong and Godzilla's just wading around trashing things. And it's not till near the very end we get any real sense of, you know, what's going on in his lizard brain. And
so you were like,
not a personality.
Godzilla, what's your motivation?
I love Godzilla. You know, I've seen all the Godzilla movies and he's more than that. So I was like, let's have a bit more focus on him. Don't just turn him into a heel, you know.
What do you think, Jack?
I agree mainly. I mean, I found the human characters very, very underwhelming. It was all a bit contrived because obviously we just want to see them punch each other, Kong and Godzilla. I was just waiting for it
just
to happen.
Just filler, you know. Isn't it, when people are on?
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then they kind of have a little fight and then they both leave each other and go their separate ways for a bit. And it takes an hour or so for them to kind of get back together. So it's like a little tease and then a lot of waiting around. Kong goes to this location. I don't know how much you want to go into it, but I really enjoyed the look of it, the spectacle of where they go with it. I thought it was really cool. You know, they have a few other monsters here and there, and I thought that was all really fun. There were so many humans in it, and so many of them did, you know, basically nothing. I mean, the worst example was probably Lance Reddick. I don't know if you saw him. He's in it for about 30 seconds, and he just suddenly, like, pops up, and it's just very odd.
Maybe he's a big Kong Godzilla fan and he just wanted to be there.
Well, he was supposed to have his own storyline within the movie as well.
They've pruned storylines.
Yeah.
And would you have liked it if they'd pruned some more?
I don't know about you guys, but my main issue was probably the Millie Bobby Brown storyline.
Yeah.
I liked the Goonies-esque feel of the gang that kind of forms there, but... there was no character development there at all, really, was there? It was all a bit cliche.
This is the trouble. That trio, who, like Jack said, they do go on this sort of Goonies adventure, that you've got Brian Tyree Henry, who's kind of a whistleblower and always up on conspiracies. You know, he's a bit paranoid. And he's joined by Millie Bobby Brown, who we know from the last Godzilla movie, and then Julian Dennison. And it should have a real sort of fun vibe that they're off on this adventure to get to the truth. But they're so underdeveloped, they're given so little time, it just every now and then comes back to them. But that whole subplot, it just feels utterly disposable. And Julian Dennison, who we all know from Hunt for the Wilder
People,
doesn't
get to do any of his charming stuff,
does
he?
Yeah, he's wonderful. He's so good in Hunt for the Wilder People. And we did him in the magazine, I think, last month. And he's so witty and fun. And it could have just been anyone in that role. It's just like he's got a handful of lines. And it's like, what's the point of hiring the guy? It's just so disappointing.
Agree. And then you've got Isa Gonzalez jetting in on a helicopter to literally look good wet, as far as I could tell. Yeah, I'm the same as you guys. I loved whenever the two beasts were having a go. I loved Kong going to the hollow earth and like swinging things round by their tails and bashing other creatures. It's visually sumptuous and exciting. It's this ridiculous destruction porn, isn't it? I mean, like, they smash each other into buildings and you've killed thousands of people. So it's like, you can't then ask us to care about people in these smaller stories without actually addressing the fact that you're just stomping on people. Millions of people that you're being killed. Yeah. And I've had this problem throughout, I think, for the whole of this MonsterVerse. I don't really want to be bothered with the people. I'm just interested in the creatures.
Yeah. The thing is, I'm all for good characters in blockbusters. We all are. And throughout this MonsterVerse, they're always talking a good game. Gareth Edwards, who did a brilliant film in Monsters, he was saying like, oh, you know, the humans are as important as Godzilla in my film. And then they were underwhelming in the first Godzilla movie. Godzilla, King of the Monsters, was awful with characters. You know, it just didn't have anything. And then the director of this one, Adam Wingard, he again has really talked up the fact that, you know, we've really learned from the last movie and the characters are going to be great in this and there's so much going on. And then you see the film and it's like, well, no, you haven't really learned much at all, have you? You're talking a good game. But it's just like, if you're going to have lots of characters, make them interesting. Go back to the days of Spielberg in the 70s with Close Encounters, where you really got into the characters and cared about them and went on their journey. And if you can't do that, or you're not willing to give them that much time, then just do away with them virtually and get to the Kong and Godzilla just trashing each other.
Just get to the good stuff.
Yeah,
because like that neon lit fight at the end is awesome. Like,
fantastic.
Yeah, and like I like the same as Jamie, like seeing just like a fun blockbuster again after so long, you know, not a 4-hour Snyder cut or something like that, but just like hour and a half or whatever it is. You know, the humans are pretty disposable, but then, you know, it makes up for it by just having, you know, these colossal fights, which are just awesome.
One other thing that should be said maybe is because Adam Wingard directed it, who did the Blair Witch reboot and he did Your Next and various other very good horror films. You may think this would go the horror route, but, you know, Godzilla and Kong both have roots in the horror genre. They kind of started out there, but he doesn't at all. It is very much a family blockbuster. So you can sit down, you know, around your TV, around your laptop, whatever, with the kids. And it's a big, bright, silly blockbuster.
Yeah.
So, you know, go for it. Just try not to fall asleep when the humans are on screen. Yeah.
Okay, so we are recommending Godzilla versus Kong as a big popcorn movie that's a little bit, well, probably won't stay long in the memory in terms of human interaction, but that's fine. Let's move on then to the world of another two big stars, Tom Holland and Daisy Ridley, in their long-delayed sci-fi actioner.
It's so loud here.
We call it the noise. Happened to all the men on this planet. Every thought in our heads were on display.
Where are all the women?
They're dead.
So this is Chaos Walking. It's Daisy, it's Ray, and Spidey, Tom Holland.
That's right.
What are they doing?
Well, first of all, Ray isn't on the screen. So we start in the world, 2257 is the year, and we're in the New World, which is a planet that has been colonized. And it's all men there because we learn that there was a big war with the indigenous species and all the women were killed. So all that is left is men. And there's Tom Holland playing Todd, There's Mads Mikkelsen as the mayor of this all-male community. There's a preacher played by David Oyelowo. And what's really odd about this world that we're kind of chucked into is that all the men can't disguise their thoughts. Whenever they speak or whenever they're thinking anything, you get this kind of ephemeral cloud around their head where you see images and you can hear what they're thinking and you get little flashes of it. So this is the world we're pitched into. And then suddenly into this world crash lands a woman, Viola, played by Daisy Ridley. And she lands in this world and kind of the men immediately take her to the settlement and she feels a bit threatened and is kind of what's going on here. And basically she goes on the run. And Tom Holland, he sets out to help her. So he goes on the run with her and they're trying to get away. It's essentially a chase movie where the mayor and the preacher and various other men are kind of chasing them down and trying to get hold of Viola.
Yeah, it's not very good, is it?
It really isn't. I mean, it finished filming originally about 4 years ago. Then it had reshoots, which were kind of put on hold because of the schedule of the stars. When you've got Ray and you've got Spider-Man involved, you can't just go, oh, we'll get together next week. So it took time. And now here we are 4 years later and it's emerged. What's disappointing is it's got interesting ideas in there, but you can tell it's kind of about toxic masculinity. And I found Todd quite an interesting character that he's kind of always trying to big himself up and try to appear capable to Viola and impress her. But his thoughts always give him away. So he says one thing and then something pops up where he's obviously just, you know, very insecure and not very capable and a bit of a child in some ways. So that's all kind of interesting stuff going on in there. But it's just so turgid and it tries to be a Western that it's kind of men on horses and chases, but it's really, really tedious. And those themes I just alluded to, it doesn't delve deep into them. It kind of sanitizes them. But, you know, in reality, if a woman suddenly appeared out of the blue into this all-male community,
it would be a very dark thing that would happen.
It would be a lot darker. And even just the thoughts, you know, because we hear everything they think, you know, there would be some unpleasant stuff popping up and it doesn't have any of that, and it just all feels like made by committee and it just does not work. And the only good thing I can say about it at all is that there are a couple of okay set pieces. There's a chase in a forest, there's some water rapids action, they're okay, but everything else about this film is pretty dire.
I mean, I didn't really like it either. It's a movie that did away with any subtlety that it could have had. It's interesting that Charlie Kaufman, you know, originally was supposed to write the screenplay for this, you know, because there are obviously some really interesting ideas in here, like the indigenous species, the spackle, you know, the idea.
I couldn't help thinking of DIY. Every time they said it's the spackle, I thought about spackling a wall.
I mean,
That's how much I was enjoying it.
There's a really interesting idea there, you know, of humans coming to a planet, invading, and then the battle there. But nothing came of it at all. And the books it's based on are a trilogy. And it feels like the films were supposed to be also a trilogy. But you can see when the reshoots come in, because they wrap it up at the end in this kind of like very, very strange, kind
tonally
of
different.
Yeah.
Terrible reshoot wig action going on as well there.
Because Daisy Ridley's character, I thought she was pretty dire in this movie. She goes from this very silent character who doesn't really say anything and is suddenly kind of like, she's supposed to be very clever, but then at the same time, she's just like, that was terrible podcast material.
For those who aren't seeing this, that was an open slack-jawed face.
That is what she's doing. And then suddenly they're just like, oh, we really need to wrap this up. Okay, let's get the next two movies of character arc in here quickly. And then suddenly she's just like, we need this, this, and this. Let's go here and fix this and that. And it's just like, wait, what? This is
why didn't you do that at the beginning, love?
Yeah, this is what she should have been doing the whole time. Yeah. It's like, you know, Daisy Ridley went, actually, you know, you've really done my character not very well here. Let's make her good. I mean, the fact that her name's Viola, she's a woman who's shipwrecked, it's like obvious the 12th night.
Yeah,
it's like, okay, great, it's a bit on the nose. And that's pretty much how I felt about the movie.
There are feeble attempts at sort of talking about feminism and capable women, toxic masculinity, misogyny, the idea of isolated communities that don't speak to each other and a lack of a sort of joined up vision. The whole idea, as you say, of displacing indigenous species, of even to some extent sort of environmental issues of having to leave a planet because we've destroyed it and we're looking for a second place. There's all sorts of things going on here, all put in a bag, jumbled up with no real direction or tone that's holding throughout. And then you've got a load of really great actors in here. Damien Bircher, you've got Mads Mikkelsen, you've got David Oyelowo. Nick Jonas. I mean, actor. You've got a load of potential here that isn't being realized. And you're right. It does feel like too many people had a opinion on it. And there doesn't appear to be somebody who's got a real focus and sticking to an idea. I just feel like this was really bleak and dark. This could be really, really interesting, couldn't it?
It should have been. David Oyelowo, I mean, he is up with Julian Dennison for this week's Most Wasted Actor Award because, again, he's given absolutely nothing to do and he's such a tremendous talent. And I wonder how much of his performance ended up on the cutting room floor. But where this is particularly disappointing is the talent involved. But it's directed by Doug Liman, who did Born Identity and Edge of Tomorrow. You know, it's Patrick Ness did the books, the trilogy of books, and he wrote the screenplay. And, you know, we know him from A Monster Calls as well. Terrific writer. So you expect something very good, basically. And Lionsgate had high hopes for this, that, you know, they had the Twilight films, they had the Hunger Games films, and they really thought this is going to be their new YA series. And there's no way this is going to be a series. This is one film and out.
They really kind of ham in those YA aspects as well. It's like Tom Holland suddenly thinks like, oh, about kissing her or something. And it's just like, there was no chemistry between them for me whatsoever. I was not feeling that couple at all. Like Ray and Spider-Man do not work together. And so, I don't know, it just didn't work. The fact that they were trying to go with that angle for this story didn't work. And there's so many elements that just don't fit together right. And there is something that could have been really good in there. I think that's what's frustrating. And then it just kind of comes out as a mess.
Because it looks good. You know, it's good looking film. You've got that going for it as well. Yeah, just so many missed opportunities. And I forgot as well, Cynthia Erivo is in there as well.
Yeah.
Again, wasted. She's great and doesn't really do much.
You said that you couldn't stop thinking about DIY during the film. I was even worse for this, that every single time anyone had a little thought cloud pop up, you know, where it's this kind of mist going around their head. To me, it was just like they'd farted and there was a fart cloud. Honestly, it was so off-putting. I watched the whole film. It was like watching a cartoon with people, you know, bad wind problem through the whole film. It was, I just did not like the special effects and I could not go with it.
You could imagine having the conversation of how the hell you do show that on film. The idea that people's thoughts are constantly around them whilst they're talking, what they say and what they think are two different things. But maybe this one wasn't quite the way to go.
Little puffs. Yeah, it was a bit off-putting.
Okay, so that is Chaos Walking, which I suppose if you like Ray and you like Spider-Man, it's worth seeing what they're up to. See Ray as a Blonde. It's available on demand from April 2nd on Friday. So it's time to sex chickens. I didn't even know this was a job, but this is what I've learned from this film in this Oscar nominee.
How's your daddy like that new farm? He growing things good, doing things right?
Yes.
미국 애들은 할머니랑 같이 방 쓰는 거 싫어한다던데.
But I don't like grandma.
걔는 안 그래요. 한국애니까.
Grandma smells like Korea.
야, 뭐라고? Grandma smell?
Jack, what's Minari about? And why is it Oscar nominated?
The story of a young Korean immigrant family who moved from California to Arkansas hoping for a better life. The father figure is Stephen Yeun, who wants to start a farm, but they move to this plot of land with a house on it. The house is very run down, and the mother figure, played by Han Yeri, is very, very unhappy about this situation. But the mother and father, they make money through sexing chickens, which is putting the male and female chickens into different boxes. But Stephen Yeun's father figure, he's very determined. He doesn't want to spend money on anything that he could do himself, which includes finding a water well for his farm. So there's a man who comes around with a stick and is like, oh, I'll help you get water. He's like, no, I'll do this ourselves. But things don't go so well initially. And a grandmother comes to stay. She comes over from Korea to help look after the children.
It sounds like it's an immigrant story, but actually it's a sort of an American dream story, isn't it? I don't think you necessarily would apply that this is purely Korean. This is a dream about bettering yourself, the American dream of finding land, finding water, making your own business, bettering yourself, finding a house for your children, all of this sort of thing. And controversially, in the Golden Globes, it won Best Foreign Film because it's in Korean and English, but the director has argued that it is an American film because he's an American and it's about immigrants who are in America. So it has sort of caused up a little bit of controversy, but does it work? Is it something that's going to win Oscars?
I'm not sure it will win Oscars. I mean, it's been nominated for 6, including the big ones, Best Picture, Best Director, Actor, Supporting Actress, Screenplay. So, you know, big gongs, but I think it is fully, fully deserving of all of those nominations. It's a wonderful film. It's very sort of quiet and unforced and just concentrates on the day-to-day life. You know, there's not a big sweeping arc or propulsive plot. It's just kind of watching this family struggle as they go about building the American dream. And it's full of hope, but it's not kind of naive or too optimistic. And at the same time, you know, there's loads of hard scrabble reality and things going wrong. It doesn't go too far in that direction either, where it's like really depressing. It's just this wonderful tightrope walk between the tones. And, you know, it's just a really charming, really well-made, lovely little film. So I think it deserves all the nominations. Whether it will actually turn them into wins, I'm not sure. I don't think
not
it
even
will.
For Alan Kim.
Alan Kim is wonderful. He's a little mischievous boy. He's like 7 years old.
He's so delightful.
His grandmother's really mischievous as well. So between them, they kind of get up to all sorts. And he is an absolute delight. But no, I think it's going to be one of those films where the 6 nominations are going to be enough, you know, and hopefully that would get people out to see it. It first premiered in Sundance last year, way back in January, and got rave reviews there. And it's been one of those films on the festival circuit all year, and everywhere it's gone, it's just delighted people. It's a real heart warmer. So I do hope it finds a big audience, because I think people, especially now, will fall for its charms.
Was it delightful for you, Jack?
I did very much enjoy it, but I just felt a real sense of dread throughout it, like something was going to go really, really wrong. And I found that quite distracting in a way, even though what was being shown, you know, like the mischievous kid and stuff, like I found that all really enjoyable and quite fun. There was just a real sense that this things are going to go really bad at some stage. And I found that quite difficult because I really liked them as characters. And so I kind of struggled with that element of it because I didn't want things to go badly.
But isn't that the point of it, that these are the struggles that people go through that are sort of, you don't have a great deal of money. They're trying to, you know, make a bit more money. They're trying to give the children, you know, the things that they possibly didn't have. That always in the background of sort of taking a risk on something, which is what he does with this farm, there is the chance that you could fall on your ass. And that's a reality for a lot of people who are trying to sort of live their life with no real buffer.
That's what I mean, because you know that those are the realities and that is what will inevitably happen. That is why I was just like, the whole time my heart was just like crunched up, because I was like, oh no, please, is this when it's going to go wrong? Is this going to be...
you enjoy the highs more, that when things go right, you really take pleasure from that as well?
I think so. And I think what was interesting is that it definitely subverted my expectations in the end, because it does something quite interesting in the way it unfolds as well. And I thought all the performances were really excellent in it. Stephen Yeun is really good. I thought he was just so believable and just so surprisingly understated but charismatic at the same time. And the grandmother, played by Yoon Yoon Jung, she was just excellent. She was such a great character as well, kind of being a force for, I mean, mischief is such a good word for it, because you know, you're not sure if she's actually helping or if she's not. And it's just, She's really excellent. I loved her dynamic with the grandchild as well. There was a lot to really love in this one, even if I was watching it with a sense of dread, not wanting anything to happen to them.
It's one of those films as well that I don't know if you found this or if you knew the backstory beforehand, but I saw it a while ago and I was watching it just thinking this feels so real and lived in and detailed. And I thought, I'm sure this must be like autobiographical. It really must be. And then I read up on it, and the director, Lee Isaac Chung, his family came to America and they started a farm in Arkansas. So
and it his is parents at least were chicken sexers.
Yeah, yeah. So there's a lot of detail in there, and you can really sense it. It just doesn't feel sort of made up for drama's sake. It just feels someone who's lived it.
Yeah, that's the word I would sort of use about it. It feels incredibly authentic, every part of it. You know, even the sort of local oddball guy that people laugh at who drags his cross down the road every Sunday and is sort of an odd chap but incredibly kind. I just felt like that's a guy we've all seen in different communities, played by Will Patton, really, really good. Mm-hmm. And the whole dynamic of the economic stresses on the husband and wife and how that's fracturing their relationship, and then you throw into that the mother-in-law, that doesn't help. And yet at the same time, possibly it does. And that this culture clash between the young boy played by Alan Kim, who is, you know, interested in eating white American bread, and he doesn't want stinky grandma to come with her weird potions that she's brought from Korea, which just look delicious, don't they? All of that just felt really incredibly authentic. And it just was living, stepping into someone else's shoes for an hour and a half, which is what you want from a film, isn't it?
And the farm they're trying to build as well is, you know, a farm to grow Korean vegetables and then to sell them to sort of other Korean immigrants nearby. And, you know, I like that about it, because I don't think I could have taken it if they were building a farm with like animals and then off to the slaughterhouse. That would have been too much for me. So as a vegan, so I'll get that in there. Yeah. So I found that very lovely.
I like that it's a vegan-friendly movie. I think we should put that disclaimer whenever Jamie comes on for every movie.
Yes, this is vegan-friendly. And also the title, Minari, is a herb that grows in a sort of shallow wetland area that is a tasty thing that you put in Korean recipes. So in case you're wondering, that's what that is. So again, perfectly good for you, Jamie. Vegan, the Minari plant. You can eat that.
I'm happy with that.
Great. Okay, so that is Minari. And that is available on demand from tomorrow, Friday, the 2nd of April. Okay, so finally, our final film. As journalists, this one is a very sobering documentary.
Jamal Khashoggi, prominent Saudi journalist and Washington Post columnist, has gone missing after visiting his country's consulate in Istanbul.
He was last seen entering Saudi Arabia's consulate, seeking paperwork to marry his fiancée.
His fiancée saw him go in at 1 p.m. and was still waiting for him at 1 a.m.
Buhar olup uçmadı.
Saudi Arabia now suddenly is admitting that Khashoggi did die inside that building.
Jamal Khashoggi alelade bir şekilde öldürülmemiştir.
Okay, so this is a documentary focusing on Jamal Khashoggi and his death in the Saudi Arabian embassy in Turkey, which caused absolute uproar when it happened, because obviously he had, as a Saudi journalist who had been critical of the Saudi government, he had gone to the embassy to get some papers sorted out for his upcoming marriage and had never been seen again. So this documentary is quite probing into not only the circumstances surrounding that and what may have happened and who may have been responsible, but also the wider, more insidious aspect of the danger that people live under if they are dissenters to Saudi law and Saudi government and the way things are run there. It's not for the faint-hearted. How did you find it, Jamie?
I thought it was really, really powerful. I didn't know a great deal of the story, I have to admit. I mean, probably many people do. I'd kind of miss this completely on the news. So I didn't know where it was going. And it is just what happened to this man, given he had a huge social media following. He wrote for the Washington Post. He was an author. You know, it kind of beggars belief that it was a state-sanctioned assassination. Turkey released surveillance tapes from the embassy in Istanbul where it happened because they were outraged by it. So that kind of showed what happened, and, you know, there's no guessing around it. And it's just...
incredibly brutal what happened.
It's absolutely brutal. It's not just an assassination. It's the way it's planned out and how they go about it and how they dispose of the evidence is just absolutely horrific. And then what I also found just incredible and fascinating about it is it goes into how, because Khashoggi had such a social media following, and this goes for various other dissenters as well, the Saudis employed this ginormous army of trolls. They call them the flies. That every time Khashoggi put a tweet out there or whatever, all these flies would descend on it and kind of furnish him with loads of abuse and just sort of put down what he'd said and say, oh, it's rubbish, fake news, whatever. It's just incredible to see this kind of, you know, the Russians do the same with bots, but it just shows how vicious social media can be and how, you know, governments and whatever can control things and control news and what goes out there. And for me, it was just a real eye-opener. Maybe I'm a bit naive. Yeah, I kind of sat there with my mouth open for the whole film. It's really powerful stuff.
Yes, and it's as much about, you know, the importance of freedom of speech and the importance of news that is real, so to speak, in quotation marks, and the power of propaganda, isn't it? And also the fact that it does focus, obviously, on Khashoggi, but also on other people who are living a similar life right now, who are moving constantly, who are constantly having to change their phone, who get messages that your family's not safe. They can never, ever see their families again. They can never return home because the consequences are absolutely dire. And this particular case illustrates just how dire those consequences can be. It's up for awards, yeah, Isn't it, Jamie?
Yeah, but this is another one that surprised me by missing out on the Oscar nomination because it got a Best Documentary nomination at the BAFTAs. I mean, it has been an incredibly strong year this year, so to get it down to 5, you know, is very difficult. But this is a really powerful, really important documentary that everywhere it's played, it's, you know, got rave reviews. And I was kind of surprised that it didn't get an Oscar nomination to go with the BAFTA.
Yes, but as you say, there's been some cracking documentaries out this year. So maybe it just got lost in this year's selection. But it is a film that feels incredibly urgent. And especially, yeah, we're seeing this more with all sorts of different regimes. You mentioned Russia there. It's sort of a thing that you want to watch so that you are aware to question what you see. As a journalist as well, it's important to see people that are doing journalism that is much more important than what we're doing, like real life and death journalism, whereas we just talk about films.
So I take my hat off to men and women around the world who are political journalists and very often risk their lives whilst doing it.
It should be said as well, it's directed by Brian Fogel, who actually won the Best Documentary Oscar a couple of years ago for Icarus, which was kind of sports doping. So, you know, he is a filmmaker of note and he's done another movie of great note. So I highly recommend this. Me and Jane both do, I'm sure.
Yeah, Jack didn't see it because he's just a slacker.
He is. He watched, I think you watched Chaos Walking again, didn't you? You wanted a second look at it instead.
Yeah. I put two goes in on Chaos Walking to make up for it.
That's the journalist integrity of Jack Shepherd. Didn't bother watching this one.
I didn't read my emails properly, to be honest. Didn't see it.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is Journalism 101. Attention to detail.
I think his lockdown fringe got in the way when he was trying to read that email.
You couldn't read the email for the hair.
Beautifully foppish.
So that is The Dissident, which is available on Amazon Prime now. Well worth a look. Okay, so before we go, it's time for a reader's question. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Who's your favourite cinematic journalist? This ties in nicely to this week when we're talking about journalists. Who's your favourite?
I don't know if this is a slight cheat. I'm going to go with a columnist, which is, a columnist is a journalist, isn't it? It's J.J. Hunsaker in Sweet Smell of Success.
Yeah.
1957, because he's played by Burt Lancaster and he's just vile, he's cynical, he's manipulative, he's powerful, and it's just a staggering, towering performance in this great, great movie. If you haven't seen it, please do. Even though he kind of drips acid, you just can't take your eyes off him. It's one of the great screen performances for me, so I'm going to go with him. Bit of nastiness.
Totally agree. Jack?
I am going with Anne Hathaway in The Devil Wears Prada. I too would like to work for a glam fashion mag and get a glam makeover.
What do you already do? You work for Tony Film. That is glam.
It is glam. But as you can see, Jane and Jamie, unfortunately not the readers, can see that I need a actual glam up. in the way yes. I look currently with a haircut, as we've mentioned. I need a glow up. And I think she's an aspirational journalist because she also doesn't do any journalism, but seems to enjoy the life of it. And I think that's all what we really want, don't
we? That's what we're all striving for, to be journalists without doing journalism. That is a problem with journalism on film, yeah. isn't it? Very often somebody works in a magazine. I'm thinking of Kate Hudson in How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days, and she's got a whole month to do one feature and nothing else.
Yeah.
You often see this, that journalists, unless they're Woodward and Bernstein, they're not really actually doing much work.
They don't do any work. And like you said, they have weeks and weeks and weeks to do a feature. And then they all live in like gorgeous flats and apartments and loft conversions, which are worth God knows how much. And yeah, I don't think they do much research into this. I think they should come along to the Total Film office and see everyone beavering away. Yeah, it's not quite as glamorous as you think.
You can hear the depression in Jamie's voice.
I can.
There.
Oh,
I know you're
yeah.
bring it down. Come on.
No, there's great sides to it as well. Of course, it's a wonderful job, but it's not like you see in the movies.
My journalist would be Joe Bradley in Roman Holiday. Ah. Peck on his Vespa, ferrying the lovely Audrey Hepburn's princess around the Roman sites for a little 24-hour release from her regal duties. I love his character arc in that, the fact that he wants to get an exclusive but falls in love with her, so what does he then do? And it feels, you know, like you could totally make that film now and probably keep it pretty much the same, and it would be the same issues of what you do and the integrity that you have and whether you sell someone out that you love now more than ever, possibly with the royals. So yeah, it would be Joe Bradley. And also, just, you know, I would love to spend the day with Joe Bradley on a scooter eating ice cream in the Spanish Steps.
Well, I would love to see you on a scooter with Joe Bradley eating ice cream.
I used to have a scooter, but it's a bit dangerous in London, so I sold it because I thought perhaps best not to have one anymore. Yeah, I do enjoy a scooter.
I used to have a tricycle that I rode around the house like little Danny in The Shining, like an evil little kid.
How many years ago was this? Was that like last year when you were just
this is lockdown,
in lockdown?
Mate. This is lockdown.
this is last
what
week.
I do.
This is yes. Jamie's life.
Yes.
Well, that is an image for all of us to enjoy as we go away. Thank you, Jamie, for that.
Okay.
You in a little dungaree set in a giant tricycle riding around the halls of your house. How nice.
Yeah, looking scared, staring at those doors.
That's maybe scarier than The Shining, isn't it? That mental yes. image.
It is. And yes, that's something that we can treasure until next week. So on that note, thanks very much. Would you like to say goodbye?
Bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Here's Johnny!
Bicycle, I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride my bike. I want to ride my bicycle. I want to ride it where I like.
You say black,
I say white.
You say bar,
I say bite.
You say shark.